Welcome to Blind Like Me. It's Phil Parr, along with our guest from Canada. I'd like to say hi to Jeff Eden, sir. How are you today?
I'm fine, Phil. Thank you.
Well, very good. And you just were explaining to me what part of Canada you are in. Would you do that again, sir?
Of course. I am in southern Ontario, literally between Lake Erie and Lake Ontario, and about 15 minutes from Niagara Falls and about 20 minutes from Buffalo.
And winter comes early and stays late there, is that right?
Well, that's a perception that used to prevail. This year doesn't seem to be the case. Of course, that it is for everybody. But generally speaking, we're a little bit cooler, but our weather would be probably Wisconsin-like.
Yeah, well, to me it's cold in Wisconsin, being from Texas. It's 55 here now, today, and
I'll break my heart.
I would imagine it's much below that where you are. What does it happen to be? Do you know?
Oh, it's about 20 degrees.
20 degrees, well, all right. Sympathize with you, sir. And you've, this has been the area of that you're in now. Has this been where you grew up? Where did you?
Yes. Primarily, my father settled the family here after some moving about for work for the during the Depression and the war, and settled here and opened a business, a towing business. And of course, this is the area. I'm sure you've read about the legendary snowfall of Buffalo.
Yeah.
So he certainly got into the right business, and we. As kids, we're all part of the family service station and towing fleet.
And that included you?
Well, yes, I manned the phone.
You were the phone guy.
I was the phone guy.
Now, your level of vision is none, is that right? You're totally blind?
I was one of those kids that was over-oxygenated as a preemie. Mm-hmm. And I had sight till I was about 12. And got a bump on the head, just accidentally, just a small bump, and the typical retinal detachment and glaucoma stuff of the kids that had the same condition. So I, like most of my peers at that time, lost my sight at just at puberty.
Once one eye went, the other one followed in rapid...
One never did work well enough for me to have taken notice of it. Uh-huh. The one went, yes, and that was it. And kids around me were all having the same thing happen.
Really? No other blindness in your family? Your siblings all had good eyesight?
They did.
How many were there?
I had three brothers. I have three brothers.
Yeah.
Incidentally, two of which are U.S. citizens, one 40 years in Florida and the other one 40 years in California.
So four boys.
So they got away from the cold.
Well, they did, but four boys, that's a handful of roughhousing and ruffians.
Well, it was with a mother that was 4'9" and never weighed more than 90 pounds.
she had her hands full, didn't she? Yeah, I imagine she did. The way you talk, you must be close to around... I'm 66. You were around my age, I guess, around...
I'm 60, Phil.
60 even? Oh, well. All right. I've got 7 years, 6 years on you. You, when they decided to begin schooling you, what decision did they make?
I started kindergarten, preschool, at the local school. And for one reason and another, they decided to look at an alternative. So partway through the year, they sent me home. Then they made arrangements for me to go to the school for the blind, which was about 100 miles or so away.
Yeah.
and grade one off to the school for the blind at 6 years old.
Yeah.
I was one of those kids that bucked it all the way. I was not a happy camper at the school for the blind.
Uh-huh.
Looking back, I had a marvelous experience and a great start in life. There's no question in my mind about that now, but I was lonely. I had friends at home and a good home life. So being away from home was unpleasant for me.
And you had all those friends at home, and they just jerked you out of that situation and tossed you in the blind school. I know the feeling. I had the same problem. They started, I guess, teaching you Braille. How'd you do it?
Immediately. Yeah. And I could still see it, enough to see dots on the page, but I could not read well. And I think, in my mind, truly understand that Braille was going to be necessary. Nobody wanted to face the decline of sight, but it eventually began to give me trouble, and I knew the writing was on the wall. So the academic part was not the issue. I didn't enjoy the social environment. I thought that the staff we had were nasty and mean and played favorites, you know, all of those typical things.
And you're probably right.
Oh, I think it was.
You probably had some grounds for thinking those things. So it was not a happy thing. They sent you 9 months, and I guess this was in the early 50s, and 100 miles was still a good trek then, wasn't it?
Fortunately, my parents were prosperous enough to collect me every now and again. So every month or so, I got home for a weekend. And there was no bus connection, which was a real tragedy. Other kids would go by bus or by train,
yeah.
And there was absolutely nothing like that for me. So I had to be collected by vehicle or not at all.
Yeah, fortunately, your father had lots of vehicles, I guess.
Oh, he did that?
Being
I did make that trip in a tow truck several times.
That's what I was thinking. You probably did, and that was probably kind of a kick to see the tow truck come and get you from the blind school. After maybe the blind kids got to look at that and got a kick out of that, I would imagine.
As a matter of fact, yes. And my father was very good at giving me and any of my friends experiences. He was really tuned into the issue of being away from home, and we had kids in Canada still that were away from home through the year. When I first arrived at the school, some kids arrived in September and did not go home until June.
Whoa.
Oh, yes. These were kids from the West, and those were the days when farmers were not very prosperous, and there wasn't a lot of extra money on a train ticket or such to go back and forth and have somebody mind you on the train was a very strategically expensively done process.
Yeah.
So about my grade four year, the kids got to go home for Christmas.
And that was a big thing.
Imagine that.
Yeah.
So I began to take kids home with me for weekends.
Okay.
And that made me rather popular, and I tried not to make an issue of it. You know, I kind of understood. My parents gave me quite a scolding about trying to use that as any kind of a leverage. But some of the kids that were there long-term, I would bring them home for weekends so that they could eat macaroni and ice cream and popcorn and the things that you didn't get at the school for the blind.
Well, and you got to show off a little bit.
A little bit.
And it's impossible at that age to, you know that, but then you got to do it. I mean, you couldn't keep from it. And the kids got to see the tow truck and got to be around your dad, who was, like you said, was tuned to the problems and wanted to help. So it was a good situation for everybody.
Generally speaking, Phil, the one thing that they always remind me of, my brothers, when we get together, is the fact that at 4 or 5 years old, I would hear car engines. And because I'd heard the house and the garage were one building. These are the days of yore.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They weren't fancy. And we had three bays and a home that was not a nice home. It wasn't fancy. But that was all part of the business. So if a car was repaired, I'd hear the noises and I would hear what they had done to fix it. So my brothers still taunt me about when I go buy a car, or one goes by me, they'll say, okay, what's the matter with that car?
That's good. And you could distinguish, probably, as lots of us could, different cars, but you could tell how a car sounded. You could tell what kind of car it was.
Well, I diagnosed a taxi, hopped in one the other day, and I told him it was his inner axle bearing in the differential that was shot. And he laughed like a son of a gun. He said, I just came from the garage, and they told me the same thing.
Is that right? That's pretty nice. So you can still do that, some of that.
It never leaves you.
Cars are all computers now, but then the axle wouldn't be. It'd be the same. You know,
certain things make the same noises, though. You know, wheel bearings will forever make the same noise.
Yeah, because they're still physical things.
They haven't changed that. That hasn't changed since the turn of the last century, really.
Well, talking with people, my friend Dale Levins, who knows you pretty well, went to school with you, he seems to think that you have many wide and varied interests, that you have done many things. And as a child, what were you interested in as a youngster?
Oh, golly, Phil. Such a long time ago.
Well.
Certainly, electronics always got my interest, and I ran, I'm sure Dale may have mentioned, a little bit of a radio station at the school using one of those Nikit transmitters, which I got from Dale's brother, Doug.
Oh, yeah?
He passed it on to me, and I kept the thing rolling, and we had lots of fun doing broadcasts, and I did pick up a ham license at age 15, which at the time was the youngest in Canada that you could get your license. That was in 1962. So I'm not as active as I used to be, but there was a time when I was fairly active. And then, of course, motor vehicles always being a part of my background.
Yeah.
At age 15, I bought into my first car at $25 and got it working. And I was always have a car. When my pals were short a car, those were the days when you'd go and ask for Dad's car, of course. And if Dad wasn't going to give you a car, we'd always be short a car. So I always had one.
Well, yeah, you have a very distinguished voice. The first time I heard you, I thought, this guy would really be a great talking book narrator. You have that voice, so I knew that there probably was at one time some interest in broadcasting or public speaking or something along those lines. So you had a little radio station at the School for the Blind?
I did, and took it rather seriously, Phil, to be honest. Twin turntables, twin tape recorders, a fairly good microphone, the whole deal, you know?
And you thought that's what you were going to do? You thought that's what you might want to make a living as your vocation?
Yes, I aspired in some measure to do something like that. Yeah, and maybe electrical engineering is a step beyond that as my education increased. And, of course, then I bumped into the ever-famous Jim Swale, our fellow from Ottawa that Bill Gary and Tom Fole know from Smith Kettlewell, and anybody who had dealings with science products for the blind and such going way back. Jim was one of the early great innovators, so I looked at that as a career possibility. But you mentioned public speaking. Yes, I was kind of lucky at public speaking.
Well, what do you mean lucky?
I brought home a few trophies.
You were good at it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, don't be. It's a little. We're 60 years old. You're too old to be modest. Too modest.
Well, my brother sent two letters for it. I think they were B and S, as I recall.
Well, so you excelled at public speaking. You even though your situation being away from home wasn't good, you wanted to get into electronics. Graduated, I assume, from the school. What did they call the School for the Blind in Canada?
The Ontario School for the Blind. It has subsequently changed name, but like all schools that time,
the Ontario School for the Blind. How original, right?
Yeah.
Graduated there in probably 64, maybe? 60?
Yes, indeed, 65.
65.
Moved on to a regular school. We had a grade 13 then, which was a prep year.
I had heard that.
So I did grade 13 in my home school, which was a real dunking into the rest of the academic world, and on to university. And there I generalized for a while, and then I went to a specialty in history, thinking I would teach it, and watching a couple of teachers be destroyed by nasty students, I kind of changed my mind and went to psychology, thinking maybe I would look at something a little gentler. And when I left that, the Institute for the Blind stumbled on me and hired me to be an instructor in the then called Adjustment to Blindness program, because I had all of these other skills that I'd worked up and having a bit of a reputation as a carry-on. so there I did newly blinded males would be put into my care, poor things. And all sorts of things. We did everything from a little bit of academic work and learning Braille and doing some hand things, even leather work and such. No, we did real leather work. We didn't just stitch the stuff. I had cutting tables and stamping tools and walked them through that, really to kind of get confidence in using hands again.
Mm-hmm.
And even had some plumbing repair setups in there so people could learn how to repair household things. It was my contention that one of the problems of broken families is a blind fellow would go home and wouldn't be able to take care of his lady and his family. And as I'm sure you're aware, the rate of family destruction in those days, and perhaps even now, is really unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And these fellows have said to me in subsequent years that probably was the right thing to do. They would at least be able to go home and repair a tap and make the water closet work again and check a light, and that helped them maintain their marriage.
Well, it gave them confidence, and it gave their lady, as you said, confidence in them. So it served two purposes. Your computers, you must have mail or something coming in. Something is going on there with your computer.
Yes, I did shut it up. I hope it didn't interrupt.
No, we don't worry about those things. We don't. We're not trying to be too professional. We like a little those kinds of things. You've got your jaws cranked up there pretty fast. I couldn't understand it that fast.
Oh, I used to do 45%. I'm going down to 40. I don't think there's any need to win any races any longer.
Anymore. Yeah,
yeah.
You've won all the races you're going to win.
Yeah.
Well, you said you alluded to students being destroyed, I mean, teachers being destroyed. Are you talking about student teaching and rowdy children, that disruptive children?
Yeah.
And you didn't want to face that, and I don't blame you. As a blind, in these were not blind people. These were sighted people that were destroyed.
Yeah.
And if they'd be mean to those sighted people, well, they'd kill a blind guy, wouldn't they?
Well, absolutely. I worked in a cocktail band, which was something I did all through my teens.
Oh, yeah?
Until I was 35. Just the plain cocktail lounges and bar mitzvahs and all that kind of thing. We went on the road for a while thinking we were going to be heroes and found out very quickly that hero was a long way from our side.
Oh, man, the music business is not what you think it is.
No, sir. And I also discovered that I didn't want to drink myself to death, and I didn't want to womanize myself to death and all of that kind of stuff. So I left that behind me. What a great experience.
What instrument, what did you play?
I was a guitar player, so I'm a very ordinary guitar player.
Acoustic, electric, or
electric.
What?
Yeah.
Electric, and you folks were doing rock and roll, or you were doing...
Yeah, rock and roll, copy stuff, and we did a few things of our own, but a lot of copy stuff, and
uh-huh.
I was the arranger in the band, too. We used to do, at that, the high point of my career, I guess, is... the one band when we had brass and such, we did Joe Cocker stuff. We had a fellow in the band.
Yeah.
We used to say that Joe Cocker sounded like him.
Yeah.
And
probably some Chicago,
Chicago, exactly.
Yeah, with those horns. Now, were you the only blind person in this band? Or there were, huh?
Yeah.
And, the thing about, and I never had too many chances to go on the road, but the thing that always occurred to me about being on the road as a blind person would be every day would be new. You would be forced to learn your surroundings every day.
It was brutal.
It was it would be horrible. I couldn't do it.
Brutal. A dog was not anywhere near the picture for me, but it was brutal. I was courageous, though. With a cane, I'd go anywhere and try anything.
Sure.
And it certainly you try to restrict your activities and work out what was convenient and figure out where the local coffee shop was and get some advice or order something in. You get tired of finding things.
Yeah.
But just order something in for dinner and leave it be and just go down and do your job in the venue.
But the next day it was going to be different. That would drive me crazy.
I would try to pitch in and load the equipment and do my share and sit in the vehicle all those long hours and then unload and unpack it. And away we go again.
Yeah, I tell them now, yes, I'll play if all I have to do is walk in and sit down and sing. if I have to load and unload, you get somebody else. I won't help you. I'm not interested. I did enough of that. You know, consequently, I don't work much. No. I don't want to.
I don't know how many door frames I took out in my life, Phil, but there's a few of them.
For the first time in my life, I'm able to pick and choose what I do and don't do, and that's very wonderful.
That's one of the nice things about age. I think the other thing I read, the nice thing I asked an old gal what the best thing about being 100 years old was, he said no peer pressure.
And there isn't. That's very true. So you were musically inclined, and I guess in high school you probably pursued some music, but when you got out you played some, but all the time you were pursuing academia. You were going to college most of this time.
Yes, sir.
And studying, your degree was in psychology?
Yes, history and psychology, yes. It came out as kind of a double.
Mm-hmm.
And the psychology was the most useful. And then off to work for the training division of the local Institute for the Blind.
They discovered you and said this guy would be good. Where did you learn to do leather work? Did you learn that did they teach you that at the blind school?
I picked it up from somebody that was on the job training, and it just came to me readily. So I was able to, within a matter of a couple of weeks, basically turn it around. But it was a darling older woman from the east coast of Canada who was very patient and walked me through it quickly.
And so you were able to pass this skill or this get these folks who were newly blinded to realize that they could do something. They could use their hands.
Oh, yeah. Some got really, really good at it.
Mm-hmm.
Some people were very, a great hand-to-hand skills. And others, of course, would leave them at very simple things to do, just a kind of an interesting thing to do in their own time. But
yeah.
Some people even went out and made a little business of it for a while.
Now, but in your plumbing, I guess that skill probably came to you partly from your father's garage there. You were mechanically inclined all along.
Yeah, I wasn't afraid of blowtorches, and I wasn't afraid of saws. I'd gotten over those fears of machines and so on long ago, so I guess that helped. I never taught anybody to use a propane torch, so I was unsure that I could safely give anybody instruction with a propane torch.
But you know how to do it.
I know how to do it.
You can sweat pipe.
You bet.
That's one of the little things I learned from our friend Dale, our mutual friend. He gave us a little lesson, and I never had done it. I'd had a little torch, but I'd never done it. I still haven't done it, but I think I could.
Well, it's the sound. You need to be about an inch and a half away from the pipe and listen for that particular pitch of the sound so that you get the maximum heat of the flame on the pipe. If you're too close or too far away, it's not hot enough.
Yeah.
And you can always, as soon as you touch the solder to the pipe and it's a bit sticky, you've got it running and away you go.
Well, you don't want to touch it. You want the pipe to heat the solder, right? I mean, that's the trick.
Yeah, you heat the pipe and then you touch the solder to the pipe, it up against the side of the joint, and you can feel it bump there.
Yeah.
And you can feel it give way.
Well, I may never do it, but I think as long as I think I could, what the hell's the difference?
You bet. Absolutely. You got it.
You're 66 years old. Mm-hmm. I can call somebody if I have to. Your electrical engineering, your interest in electronics and things of that nature kind of fell by the way. What was the deal there?
The ham stuff is still in the back of my mind. I still affect some of my own repairs. I did a little soldering a few weeks ago because I've lost a lot of the use of my hands. I developed kind of an oddball adult MS a number of years back, which has stopped me from running. I can still walk, but running is not in the offing. And my hands feel like I'm wearing gloves. Well, I can't read Braille.
Really?
I can't pick up little wee parts. That's more debilitating than you can ever possibly imagine.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
I can't read labels. I can't label anything.
And you can't pick up parts, little small...
Little tiny parts, little screws.
Small things. This is not repairable through drugs or through anything?
No.
This is the way it's going to be.
Yeah, this is it, unless they come up with a miraculous... improvement in the drugs they're giving us now, yeah.
Which they may.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, yeah, it's the right time to be alive.
It is, to have those sorts of things. I would, you know, I keep thinking I've got, my heart is fine, I just doesn't get much blood. If they could figure it out, and they will, maybe they'll come up with something before I go. So you worked for the state for a while, or the government there for a while. Was that your lifelong, or what did you...
It was the Institute for the Blind, which is not here, it's not state-run. Your situations there. I visited the ones in Massachusetts and in Hines in Illinois and so on. All these marvelous state ones, and I've been totally jealous about their funding base and their stability. Yeah. This is the Institute for the Blind here, which is charitably operated, and has now kind of gone out of the instruction business. We've got a couple of folks on the handyman list that one fellow on the list that would be worth getting is Armando. He's a current teacher with the Institute.
Oh, is he?
Pardon me?
I think we've had him on the Handyman Show, but we've never done his life. I'll get on that.
No, Armando's good, very skilled lad. I went to the administration section of the Institute, and then I went to technical aids in about 1983. People knew that I did this electronic stuff and said, jeepers, we need somebody to get onto these computers and things now. Would you like to do that? And I said, I don't know. You know, do I like to drink beer? You got it.
So, you bet.
I did that, and I was one of the original people out of the box doing evaluations, getting people set up with computers. And I did that until 1991. And I took a job with the City of Toronto and the planning department because I knew a lot about physical accessibility in buildings, partly with my, again, the mechanical building knowledge that sort of came all together at the right place at the right time. And I became their planner of accessibility. So when new projects would come in, they'd be presented to me to review them for accessibility components.
All right, and this happened in the early 90s, when municipalities started becoming aware that they needed to make them accessible.
That's right.
But you never did try radio as a profession, did you?
I did at school. A few of us, the local radio station had a teen thing. You could go down and participate in the teen radio. So, yes, in that measure, I did a little bit of half-hour show every couple of weeks, and that was as much as I ever did.
You never did do middays at some radio station? Because I guess radio's different up there, isn't it?
No, I don't think so.
Are there locally owned stations? I mean,
yes, by the bucket load.
By the bucket load. So that you don't have like the British have. Oh, they're all government, right?
We have one government network in FM and one in AM, and the AM is kind of a talk network where all the newsy stuff is, and the FM one is music. But the rest is all, and of course, now that the big syndicates are buying up all the stations.
Yeah.
So we have, in some measure, some extensions of your syndicated stations here.
So you have Clear Channel owning stations in Canada?
That kind of thing, yes.
That's sad. That's terrible. I would hope that you would be free of those evil people. But you know, you never did depend on that. You worked for this institute that helped blind people until you went to work for the city. And I guess that was you retired from there. Do you still do that? Or?
I left work 6 months ago on a long-term disability. I was having more trouble walking long distances still, and I'd fallen a couple of times.
Oh, man, that's not good.
So the combination of difficult hand movement and fatigue, the other part of this MS thing is fatigue, long days and so on, and falling, really put me out of it. And it was just the smart thing to do would find a new pace, a new rhythm, and maybe do some other things. So I'm doing other things.
Like what?
Well, I sit on the local committee that looks at accessibility for the town, and one for the, what we would have multiple county government here. We have a thing called a region, which used to be about 20 counties, and compacted themselves into a thing called a region. Basically, it's a numbers game, but it's more effective. The region administers major things like police and roads and that kind of thing, and health care for about 500,000.
Okay.
And each of the town governments oversee their own sidewalks and roads and that kind of thing at the town level. So I work with the region and with towns on accessibility as a volunteer.
Just as a volunteer.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, which gives you something to do. It gives you some organization to be a part of and a way to use the skills and the knowledge that you've developed.
Oh, it'd be criminal to waste the information I have to offer people. So I just, that wouldn't be, this wouldn't be the right thing to do.
Well, sometimes for the older people, it's hard to find a place because, you know, it's hard to find a use for all the knowledge that you have garnered over the years, but it's good that you can. I'm sure they appreciate your expertise.
They appear to.
They're probably glad, unless they're fooling you. They're glad to have you, right?
They appear to, yes, unless they're fooling me.
Yeah, are things going to go downhill as far as this disease goes, or
it's a case of how fast. Unless again, there's some great medical discovery, so I have to be planning for the next stage, so to speak. Be planning for maybe what I'm going to be doing about up and down stairways and that kind of thing. But it's kind of ironic that it was my profession and now I'm the one to experience the benefits of my own training.
Oh yeah, you would who to know better whether the ideas they come up with will work than you, you know. But you're still active and interested in many, many things.
Oh gosh, Phil, the some of this stuff on the internet, of course, really attracts my attention, and I have a lot of fun with that.
Yeah,
and I've got a couple of projects here that I work on too. Our local broadcast, our national broadcast service for books and newspapers, etc.
Uh-huh.
I volunteered for that. I was on its board for a dozen years, and I do work for them just whenever I can to help out anything they're doing. So I have a regular phone and email correspondence back and forth there. And there are some days I don't know how the hell I ever found time to work.
Yeah, it's busy. You get pretty busy sometimes. I have days like that, maybe one a week, when I think, geez, you know, why am I doing this? It took all day, and I'd rather be reading sometimes.
Gosh, I haven't read a book for a couple months. Just haven't had time, and I must, you know, that's on my schedule. I must read another book.
You haven't read a book for several months?
Oh, and I was a voracious reader, Phil. I've just really been busy. Part of it is getting this insurance claim stuff straightened out, too, as you know. That eats a lot of time. And, of course, Christmas and family. And I've got two kids and a granddaughter. And it's the birthday season for us, too. So that's been eating time.
So you married during all this time? You married and fathered two children?
I did.
And your wife, is she still with us?
Oh, yes, yes. My gosh, fortunately, yes, yes.
Fortunately, yes.
She makes my life easy.
Yeah. Yeah, mine also. I don't know what I'd do without that girl. She told me I could stay here whether I knew I was here or not. Which I thought was just a wonderful thing to say to a 66-year-old man.
Well, we both really missed the opportunity to come down and meet with all the crew in November. Things weren't going to work that way, but of course, you know, I've had some truck and trade with our good friend Clifford. And my wife's just in love with Clifford's voice.
Really?
She just loves Southern accents, so I'm almost afraid to bring her down there, you know.
But he's certainly got one, if anybody does. We're going to try that again, I think, in probably 08, probably November of 08. We, Max and some of us kind of decided that every 2 years would be enough. to get everybody together. So we're going to try it. No, wait, maybe you can make it then. It was great fun. It was over much too fast, but it was just wonderful to meet those folks.
Hearing all of the stories and Carla's explanation, I was really deeply regretting my absence.
Maybe in 08, plan for it. Start to thinking about it. But your life continues, and you continue to do things, and we're going to let you go pursue. Your computer just went off again, we heard.
Well, yeah, I'm sitting in the midst of reel-to-reel tape recorders and my computer and my some tools, my Dremel tools and my rechargeable drills, and next door is my table saw and all my other stuff. I still dabble, not with quite the same courage in the same speed as before, but I still build.
Now, you say reel-to-reel tape recorders. What do you use for those anymore?
Just getting old stuff off tape, so.
Oh, taking old stuff and putting it in it and digitizing it?
Yep.
Yeah, I've got so many of those I need to do, and I just can't find the energy to do it.
Well, it's hard. I'm the same. This procrastinating. Someday I'm going to give it up, you know.
Yeah, I've got so many. I've probably got 300 reels of tape and one old TIAC tape recorder, two-track, that still works. It's hooked up and ready to go. It's just the person that's ready to go is me. Not ready to go is me.
Likewise.
I can't find that impetus to do that.
Likewise.
Well, Jeff, thank you very much, sir, and I will let you know when we air this on ACB Radio and the other radio reading services, and sounds like you have things together, and keep on keeping on, and we appreciate you very much, sir.
Well, thank you for letting me share some of this. I hope that it was interesting enough for people to have stuck around and listen, Phil.
It was, sir, Jeff. Thank you very much, sir.
That's all.
I'll talk with you. Trying to do some follow-up things on people that we have previously had as guests on our show. And the first person we did back, I believe it was the summer of 2003, was a lady named Courtney Smith. And we have her back. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
I'm very well, feeling good for Sunday. Now, we had you as our first guest, and then you came to our Houston gathering.
Yes.
Brought your thing called a
theremin.
Theremin.
Yeah.
And it was just a strange piece of gear.
That it is.
It is. I love it. I'd like to take it home and play with it. I guess if I wanted one, I ought to buy one, shouldn't I?
Oh, yeah. Maybe
you could rent it to me or something.
Oh, yeah.
Courtney, I knew the first time I talked to her she was going to be my first guest. And the thing that you were interested in then, and I guess are still interested in, was flying.
Right. Yeah,
I like
planes.
Do you get a chance anymore to go flying or not?
Well, unfortunately, the chances are few and far between, because anyone in the metro D.C. area knows that there are a lot of restrictions on flying small airplanes, because we're near the White House and other other high-profile areas. So we...
Yeah, I got you.
It's not as easy as it is in most other states where you can just jump in the plane and go fly around. Here you have to file a flight plan, and you have to know exactly where you're going to go and exactly how long it will take you.
Yeah.
They took the fun out of it.
Whereas here in East Texas, you just go out to the airport and get in the plane and go.
Yeah,
right?
That's what they do in Mississippi, yeah. Where I'm from.
And you, but you live in Maryland, don't you?
Right.
Somewhere in Maryland, and you work for the Goddard Space Consortium, people, the people at the Goddard Space Center,
yeah.
And have for a number of years.
Let's see, I guess for almost 5 years. It'll be 5 years in June.
And so if you want some more details on that, you could go back and listen to show number one and what we talked about, what you do there and how it was the first day. I was just blown away by that you got that you were able to get a job there. Now, since then, I've talked to some other folks who work. I don't know if you heard it or not, but I did an interview with a guy named Kent Cullors.
Oh, yes. I've met Kent.
I think he acknowledged that he knew you.
Ah.
Works out at the SETI Institute.
That's right.
And he's very involved in all sorts of things, and we've managed over the times we've done 150 of these since we did yours, managed to meet some blind people who are doing some unusual things. I've certainly learned a lot more from this than I ever thought I would. I thought everybody was just a dullard like me and sat around and read books all day.
Oh no, see, that's a nice thing to be able to do too, though.
Well, it is, but then I've earned it. I'm 66 years old.
Hey, there you go.
And there you go. So you were born and raised in Mississippi, down in good, high class, rich surroundings, or poor child, or what were you?
I'd say it would be middle class. I never was wanting for anything.
Yeah.
When I look back at things, you know, I can say I was never, I never missed a meal. I never had to wear dirty clothes to school. Uh-huh. However, we didn't have a lot, and we made do with very little. But I would still say middle class.
And you had no blind brothers or sisters or anything?
Right.
Were you an only child, or did you have siblings?
Only child.
Only child, and you weren't around blind people, and you did not, as I recall, I can't remember, but you didn't go to a blind school, did you?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, you did,
but I went home every day. I didn't live on the campus.
You were what they call those lucky day student girls.
Yeah. It had its ups and downs. It meant that it was harder for me to stay for after school events. But luckily they gave us permission to stay in the dorm if we requested it ahead of time. We could stay over if there was an event, because there was always room.
I've talked to some other kids who said at first they thought the blind school was just bad and they wanted to go home every day, and then they got to where all their friends were there and they really would have preferred, you know, to stay because of the social stuff that
I mean, because, well, me, I lived about 25 minutes away from school, and so that wasn't a long way to go to get to school, except that I lived in a semi-rural area, so I didn't really have neighbors down the street to visit. It would be go down the road, which didn't have any sidewalks, and it would be probably my grandmother, who I'd see enough anyway, and a couple of other families who we didn't know that probably didn't have kids. It wasn't like I didn't have anyone to go. If I had, I would have gone and walked over to visit them maybe, but I didn't, and you never knew who was lurking around in the woods, so we didn't.
And there wasn't really anybody to visit anyway, was there?
Right. So I did not have a social life outside of school.
But I would bet that you didn't let that stand in your way. Now that I know you, I would bet that you explored all kind of things. I would picture you as a kid as being probably a bike rider or a trike rider.
Yeah, I did that. And also, what I did a lot of was I would have all my toys. I had lots of just junk lying around. I'd get some duct tape and some scissors, and I'd build stuff. Maybe it didn't look like anything, but it was my spaceship, or it was my, you know, something. And I would, you know, I would commandeer a corner of the living room or kitchen and turn it into a playroom, and that.
I can see that. I can see you doing that, having your own, doing your own thing, and being a brave, rather outgoing child. And your your nickname on our list is Bulldog One, right?
Yeah, 2001. Because from my college mascot was the Bulldog, And I had just graduated when I set up my email address in the December 2001, and I was, you know, all in the school spirit thing, and I said, all right, I'm setting my email address up right now, and I put in my my college mascot and the year I graduated.
Well, and then, too, I think in a lot of ways that kind of reflects on you. You know, if you've ever had a bulldog, you know how tenacious and stubborn.
Oh, yeah,
and I, now that I've met you, I can understand, as I'm married to a woman just like you, I can understand how you would be, you know, tenacious, and by God, I ain't taking no for an answer. I want to do this, and, you know, it's like this girl we interviewed the other day that that lives out in Colorado that said she wanted to be a TV reporter, and they told her it couldn't be done, and she said, yeah, but I want to do it, and
right.
So I am, you know, and she did.
See, that's, I have to remember to keep that in mind, because now when I go to work and I have work stresses and all that kind of crap, every once in a while I lose that. And luckily, my fiancé reminds me of all those things I've done and all the things I can do. And I have to remember to get back up and keep going.
Oh, yeah. We all have little periods of time. I think all blind people go through little periods of depression and wonder, why the hell, why am I, you know, why me, Lord? What have I ever done? That kind of thing. All right. Let's get to today, and you work for NASA. What do you do for them? What is your job? What do you do on a day-to-day basis?
Well, if you believe it, my supervisor even asked me that a few weeks ago.
Oh.
Well, we reorganized, as government facilities often do, when there's too much work and not enough people to do it. So what most people in my office are what they call IT specialists, but we all do different stuff. So the thing that they brought me on to do, and I still do it, and I'm still the only one who really has time to do it, is web accessibility coordination. So it's up to me to make sure that all the websites at the Goddard Space Flight Center are accessible to people with disabilities and follow the federal Section 508 requirements.
How neat. And so you get to decide if a website is not, say, blind-friendly, or, blind-friendly would be your main area.
Yeah, I mean, there are other things, but one of the biggest things, can you read the text on the page? So, yeah.
Yeah, is your screen reader just going to go nuts because there's so many graphics it doesn't know what the hell to do?
Right.
You want to, and so you get to look at these government websites and judge them. Do you have maybe a 1 to 10, or what criteria do you, you know, what is your scale?
Unfortunately, the law is kind of fuzzy on that. It's hard, you know, there's no pass with an 80%, 90%. It's either it is or it isn't, because there's a lot of subjective stuff in there.
Uh-huh.
So what I end up doing, my rule has been, and it turns out other people do this too, I look at the website, find whatever issues it has, and I go back to the people that developed it, and I said, hey, your site has some issues. If they're little ones, they fix them pretty quick. If it's going to take a while, I say, all right, well, I'll tell you what. We'll go ahead and leave your website where it is, but let's agree together on a time frame in which you can fix it. It could be 6 months from now, as long as they're making progress on fixing it. Then, but if 6 months came down the line and they didn't fix it, kind of like they put it on the back burner, then we have another little talk and go, well, we're going to take it down until you fix it. But we've never gotten to that point yet. No one's ever had their site pulled like that, and because no one means for them to be messed up. So
they just don't know. They don't understand, because they don't deal with it day on the day to day.
That's right.
But what is your redress if someone just refused? Do you have the authority to take one down?
I happen to work in the office in which all I got to do is go to the person and say, could you do the magical things in the internet world to take this website off the internet?
Really?
Yeah, and apparently it's not a big issue, not a big task, but it can be done. You just type a few commands in a certain on a certain server somewhere,
and it ain't there no more.
It's there, but probably you can't get to it from the public. Now, behind our firewall, we probably could, but no one outside would.
Now, are you a JAWS or a Window Eyes?
Well, I am a JAWS user right now, because I started using JAWS back in the days of DOS.
Nah.
But because I deal with accessibility stuff, I'm going to also be using Window Eyes so that I can make sure that both of them work with web pages and web applications, and also I think it'd just be neat to
have both.
Use something else. Yeah, and so at least at work I'll be using both, and then as I get to liking WindowEyes, I'll probably switch over at home too.
I've skipped the last two JAWS upgrades, and I figure I've saved enough now to buy WindowEyes.
Yeah, well, so here's what's funny. At work, I'm using JAWS 7.0.
Yeah.
At home, I'm still using JAWS 5.0.
Yeah.
And at home, I'm doing just fine with it.
Can't tell the difference much, can you?
Because they pay for it at work, and I have to pay for my own at home, and I haven't had the kind of dough to throw out there on it right now.
So I'm still using JAWS 6, and I think Don Shaw, who does, Don is the access technology specialist for our little college here. He says, hell, I can't tell that much difference in 6 and 8, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't know. All right. Now, the reason we called you is we wanted to update everybody on what you'd done. Maybe you'll go back and listen to show one and then compare with this. Yeah, tell us, this happened 2 weeks ago, I think, and you...
I think it was 1 week ago.
1 week, and you wrote a really nice description of what... So just start from the first and tell us.
Okay, all right. Every year, towards the end of January... In Maryland, we have what they call the Polar Bear Plunge, and it's sponsored by the Maryland State Police, and it's in order to raise money for Special Olympics. And it's held at a state park near Annapolis, Maryland, called Sandy Point State Park. And it's a nice little place on the water. And what they do is they get people to sign up to plunge into the water, which is quite cold this time of year.
Yeah.
And then you get people to sponsor you to help you raise money for this event. And because they'll either do it because they think it's a cool event, but sometimes they do it just because they say, you are crazy. So just to confirm that, I'll give you some money here.
Yeah.
You know.
Cool event. What a metaphor there. Cool.
Oh, yes.
Okay. All right. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's all right. It was a cool event.
Yeah. Ah.
And but actually, it wasn't as cool as it has been in the past. I've been there before just supporting other people who went into the water, and it probably was 30-something degrees outside. It was freezing. And it sounded like the water temperature was actually higher than the air temperature.
Uh-huh.
This year, it was a little different. The air temperature was 50 degrees, and I think the water was around 40 degrees.
So, it felt like a nice sunshiny day until you got in the water.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I changed clothes in the changing tent, which is a very large. They had two of them. They had one for women and one for men.
That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they had heaters in them. And you go in there to change clothes, and you're kind of warm. You get all dressed. They say, "Ooh, I need some air. It's hot in here." You go out there on the beach, and you're really not freezing. And then there were just this unbelievable amount of people out on the beach to go into the water.
Yeah.
Because I think all in all they had about 8,000 people go into the water.
You had found some sponsors, and do you know how much money you came up with?
I personally only came up with about 270 because I didn't sign up until kind of late. But several people at work gave me some money,
yeah.
And I put in some on behalf of some family members who do not have web access and mm-hmm. couldn't get their form filled out in time. So I put it in for them, and they reimbursed me. So, yeah, I had about 270, but all in all, they raised over $2 million. They're still tabulating because there's still money coming in. But
yeah.
They broke a record that day.
And you, because you had $270. I think that's good. And tell us your unique method for not getting lost.
Oh, yes. Yeah. My fiancé, Scott, who I admire, was not going to get into the water, even though he grew up in Massachusetts in Cape Cod, and he went to college in New Hampshire, and he interned in Alaska. He did not want to get into this 40-degree water. So I had some nylon rope in a backpack, which I usually use for search and rescue stuff with the Civil Air Patrol, and I had way too much rope, so I could afford to take some of it off. I cut maybe 10 feet, and I should have cut more of it, and I tied a small loop in either end, and I gave him one end, and I took the other. So when they did the countdown, and they gave everyone the word to plunge, I left him there at the edge of the water, and I went out as far as the rope would go. and then I just splashed around in the water. When I was ready to come back, which wasn't very long, I came back.
I can imagine.
With the rope back.
But you weren't trying to pull him in the water. You were just trying to be to have an anchor place.
Yeah. Now, next year, we'll see what that. No, I threatened him a few times when he was picking on me. I said, all right, pull that rope.
Just got a little quick jerk and you're dead.
But no, I wouldn't do it. Because he was being very polite and very gentlemanly and carrying all of our stuff, all the clothes I was wearing before I went out into the water and the backpack with the towel and all that stuff. So he didn't need to go into the water.
Well, I had a chance to meet Scott, and if I had one word to say for Scott, he's a keeper.
He's
a keeper. And besides that, I don't know any other meteorologists, and I'm just happy to know him. We're going to sit around and drink beer and talk weather when y'all come to Texas.
There you go.
But he held the rope. You went in the water and stayed, what, 30, 40 seconds? As long as you got
probably,
in.
Probably so. And it was interesting because I didn't think, ow, this is cold. But somebody said something to me, asked me if I was all right, because I was, you know, they saw this was a blind person going in the water.
Yep.
And I said, yeah, I'm all right, but I noticed I sounded like I was shaking. So I didn't feel like I was, so I think my body was revolting against me.
Yeah.
It was saying, do you realize what you just did?
You idiot. Yeah,
exactly.
I love it.
So I didn't notice, and I think it numbs you so fast that once you get out of the water, you don't realize how cold you are, and then you thaw out, and then you're still not cold. I still wasn't cold. In fact, I was standing there in the air. I wasn't cold. So then, because there were so many people, they had to do it again to let more people go out there. And I said, you know what? I think now there's people going back. I think I'll go back just because I want to make sure I'm getting the experience correct.
Did you?
And I did it again.
Oh. And you are. See, that's why you're the bulldog, because you never give up.
I probably should be a lab, though, because I like water so much.
Well, I'm very proud of you for doing that. I think that's a wonderful thing for a blind person to do. Did you get any, I guess the newspaper didn't come by and take your picture, and you know, blind girl does. They didn't do
the
that.
The thing is, I live in NFB territory, I guess, because their headquarters are in Baltimore. And they're so used to blind people doing everything around them, I guess, and getting publicity for it.
Yeah.
One little blind person going into the water amongst 8,000 people, one, you probably couldn't see me out there. And two, they'll go, well, so?
Yeah. Well, I think that's great. A lot of blind folks wouldn't have had that sort of nerve, first of all, and maybe not, the nerve to go out and make a possible fool of themselves doing this thing that it's kind of a sighted person thing. But you did it, and let me just speak for blind mankind. Thank you. That's a great thing to do, Courtney. And next year, we'll do it again next year, and maybe next year we can, if Scott doesn't go in the water, maybe we can persuade him to take a tape recorder and get us some actual footage.
I need to get one of those recorders and stereo mics.
Those stereo mics. Did you hear that in Houston's binaural microphones? Did you hear that?
Amazing.
I'm taking it to the Super Bowl party today and wowing everybody with that. Even sighted folks, think it is. Listen, I'm going to go, and thank you very much, and good for an update on your life, and keep on keeping on. And you and Scott could fly to Texas and rent your car and drive up here, take about an hour and a half to get to my house this summer and spend a couple days, and we'll swim in the pool and talk and have a good time, and I mean it.
We'll do it.
Y'all come on.
We will.
All right. Tell him hi, and I'll talk to you.
All righty.
Thanks, Courtney.
All right. Thank you.
Bye-bye.